I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FU Network TV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
Expecto ignoramus. Mouse gave me that help because the first fake Harry Potter spell I came up with ended up being a lewd reference to a sex act by accident. I was playing on the word fallacious. You can imagine where that went. Yeah, so this is the Broken Clock podcast, and we are tackling the J.K. Rowling, as I've taken to naming it, Horcrux blog, because something evil has been infused in this in an attempt to safeguard something. I don't know what. We can you know, engage in conjecture all we want, but that's not what we're going to do today. We're going to focus specifically on the errors in critical thinking. This blog post, Mouse and I agree, could be used to teach critical thinking, because
I do agree that this is a Horcrux blog, because, you know, in the Harry Potter lore, to create a Horcrux, you have to kill something. And critical thinking was killed in order to create this blog.
Again and again and again, and in very, very violent ways. So it's long. And I don't know where to start except at the beginning, because the first sentence, if you haven't read this, it's on jkrowling.com. I believe, and it's one of those weird things that it's like, the Ichabod is out, and are there more Harry Potter books coming? And then, boom,
this thing.
But I think that's part of it is, I'm not going to get into my emotions on this because it's not relevant to this, but a lot of people are reeling from this. And, you know, the fact that you can call BS on the very first two sentences, which are, this isn't an easy piece to write, appeal to emotion, for reasons that will shortly become clear. But I know it's time to explain myself on an issue surrounded by toxicity. I write this without any desire to add to that toxicity. Is BS a logical fallacy?
I wish it
were. Is there a fancy word for BS?
Like stinky sophistry?
Yeah, like, I write this without any desire to add to that toxicity. That's nonsense. It's complete nonsense, because she then goes on to talk about controversial people and controversial views in a highly emotional way. That is manipulative. The thing that irks me so much about this piece of writing is, first of all, it's very clear that J.K. Rowling is very good at making things up, but not good at backing up things with reasoning. She's a fiction writer. That's what she's good at. But this is a shining example of why people should not step outside their specialty, especially when your specialty is completely at odds with what's needed in a particular instance. Now, I think she actually, Mouse, I don't know, before we really get into it, I want to ask you, I think she might have been better off doing what she claims at the start she intended to do, just giving her reasons, like just explaining herself, not trying to make a case, just keeping it personal and saying, here are my reasons, not this is what science says, this is what I believe, and this is why. I think she actually would have been on more defensible ground had she done that. What do you think?
I think so too, because, well, first of all, just as it is, the title of her blog is misleading. She says J.K. Rowling writes about her reasons for speaking out on sex and gender issues.
Right.
It is not J.K. Rowling lectures you on what she considers to be the true fact behind sex and gender issues, which is what this article quickly turns into.
Yeah.
And with, oh no, I'll leave that for later. There's yeah, just way also, so much to unpack.
It's also, I mean, if it's just, this is my opinion, she's not committing a burden of proof fallacy.
Right.
Meaning she's not stating something and demanding other people disprove it, which is what she's doing all through this. Now, I'm going to skip the first one. Okay, there is an appeal to authority in the third paragraph. I'm going to skip over the secondary things that people may or may not know about because they're not relevant
right.
to this blog post. The only, you don't really need context for this blog post because there really is no justifiable context, but J.K. Rowling basically came back to the internet a couple weeks ago to promote a free children's story called The Ichabog. And she was offering that, and then she decided to call out this very wonky article on menstruation and menstruation taboos around the world that referred to people who menstruate, and she took great exception to this because they didn't say women. They said people who menstruate.
Menstruate.
Now, upon reading the article, that was actually the correct term because they weren't speaking about young girls or pre or postmenopausal women. Mm-hmm. They were speaking about people who have to deal with periods, which, yes, there's a Venn diagram there that overlaps with women, but some trans men have periods, some intersex people have periods, some women do not have periods. So people who menstruate is the accurate term. And J.K. Rowling could use a dose of sticking to the accurate because I'll stick to the first where I went, when she says, I've met trans people and read sundry books, blogs, and articles by trans people, gender specialists, intersex people, psychologists, safeguarding experts, social workers, and doctors, and followed the discourse online and in traditional media. This is irrelevant. Now, the problem is this arguing tactic, which is sort of a combination appeal to authority, bandwagon fallacy,
anecdotal evidence.
The Texas sharpshooter fallacy, aka cherry picking data clusters.
I mean, you have to admire just how thoroughly compounded all of those fallacies are in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real cluster of them. Of course, then the genetic fallacy as well, that judging this is good because of where it came from. Uh-huh. As opposed to whether or not it makes sense. And
right. Also known as the appeal to tradition.
Yeah. So
I had to get the musical theater reference there to get me through this.
The coping mechanisms are going to kick in hard here.
Yeah.
and the thing I want to be very, very clear about, and this is the thing that gives a lot of people a really hard time when they start into the process of learning critical thinking. It is true that people use these sorts of logical fallacies all the time. If you watch any cable news or read any sort of political media, meaning all media in this day and age, you will encounter logical fallacies and cognitive biases
up the wazoo.
Regular. Yeah, you become so immersed in them that you start having trouble recognizing them for what they are. And this is why Horcrux blog posts like this are so dangerous to the discourse, because they work, because then she goes on, oh, all these things, I am being cerebral about this. And then she protests too much again. This is also, the Hamlet post in the Lady Doth protest way too much. On one level, my issue in this has been professional because I'm writing a crime series set in the present day and my fictional female detective is of an age to be interested in and affected by these issues herself. But on another, it's intensely personal. That last part is accurate. There is no professional curiosity on this. She could write a story about a fictional female detective that doesn't even touch on these issues at all.
Exactly.
You know. She then goes back to talking about how mistreated she's been. Appeal to emotion, appeal to emotion, appeal to emotion. Right? Mm-hmm. A combination of in-group bias and the curse of knowledge. You know, what's the cognitive bias where the more angry people get at you, the more you believe you're correct? Oh, backfire effect. That's
backfire effect.
Right, right. I actually have charts in front of me to remind myself of all these things. There is a cognitive bias called the backfire effect, which when your core beliefs are challenged, it can cause you to believe them even more strongly.
Yeah.
And that's going on a lot here. So I'm going to skip through her complaining about being canceled and treated poorly online, except for the line, I must have been on my fourth or fifth cancellation by then. For people who don't know what cancellation means as a meme or a jargon of pop culture right now, it means you lose your job, right? Mm-hmm. It's very hard to be canceled more than once because after the first cancellation, you're kind of ruined.
Yeah. Right?
You cannot be canceled four or five times. That, you know, I think she was attending hyperbole, but it was actually a fallacious statement. She's just saying something that is not possible. And then she uses literally the wrong way, but I think it's a quote. And she throws in a bunch of words that she's been called, which are irrelevant to her central thesis. Yeah. Terribly inappropriate for a person whose primary job is writing youth and children's literature and only intended to trigger other women emotionally, to try to bring them on to her cause. And then she hits the appeal to popularity. And I don't know about you, Mouse. This part is
my favorite part
of the whole thing in terms of just writing because of the mixed metaphor.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read it not because it makes a point, just because I was so bothered by the fact that this is a woman who's made millions and millions and millions of dollars writing. And she came up with this sentence. What I didn't expect in the aftermath of my cancellation was the avalanche of emails and letters that came showering down upon me. That mixed metaphor just kills me. And I know that's petty, but to me, things like this are a sign where she should have caught herself at that moment and realized she's better than this.
Well, this is the moment where you can identify the writer as sort of being foaming at the mouth at
times. Okay, so it's not just me.
No, no, no. The entire, let me tell you, finish reading it and I'll tell you how it my immediate thought when I read this paragraph was.
Okay, what's coming up is something called an appeal to nature, but also appeal to the crowd, but what's it also called when the people who agree with me are good people, mm-hmm. the people who agree with me are bad
people. Bad people.
Yeah,
oh,
I forget
God,
what
yes.
that's called, but it's a cognitive bias. That's not a logical fallacy.
It's a cognitive bias, but it's also a modified poisoning of the well.
Yeah, I guess you could. Yeah, I guess you could claim it's a modified two quoke that you say I'm bad, you're bad. Mm-hmm. But this avalanche of shower, I can't stand it. The overwhelming majority of which were positive. The emails. Now, keep in mind that if people have her email, they know her personally.
Yeah.
So it's a biased sample. But they came from a cross-section of kind, empathetic, and intelligent people, some of them working in fields dealing with gender dysphoria and trans people, who are all deeply concerned about the way a socio-political concept is influencing politics, media practice, and safeguarding. They're worried about the dangers to young people, gay people, and about the erosion of women and girls' rights. Above all, they're worried about a climate of fear that serves nobody, least of all trans youth, well. There's so much there. Like, whether they're good people is irrelevant to whether they are right.
Yeah.
You know, get what field they work in will give them access to better information, but it does not in and of itself make them correct. That's an appeal to authority fallacy. And she's begging the question over and over and over again. There is a problem. And the proof that there is a problem is that all these people are concerned that there's a problem. Like, it's really manipulative. And all the words about, you know, kind, empathetic, and intelligent people who are afraid, right? She's actually leveraging a really sexist portrayal of women that is all through her books as well,
yeah.
Right? That fear holds women back, and that the natural place for a woman to be in is afraid, right? Yeah. Then she talks about stepping back from Twitter many months before and after her original cancellation. Well, there's, you know, if I were reading this as like as a, you know, an interviewer to try to look for deception, you can't react to an event before the event happens.
Yeah.
So I'd question why she stepped back from Twitter before her first alleged cancellation. And then, because I knew it was doing nothing good for my mental health. That's the first tell that she's compromised here, mm-hmm. You know? And what follows, I want to get your opinion on this because I believe this is one of the biggest outright lies she tells in this whole piece. This isn't a fallacy. This is dishonest. She said she only returned to Twitter because she wanted to share a free children's book during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the problem with that. If that's so, why'd she comment on an article about menstruation?
Mm-hmm.
If that's all she wanted to do, why didn't she stick to that?
Yeah, and besides, she has publicists. She has a website that has an enormous amount of traffic. Does she really think that children are trolling Twitter for free books?
Well, I do think it's this is irrelevant to the topic at hand, but I do think it's interesting that the stars of the movies made on her based on her books are navigating the internet and managing to insulate their mental health much better than her, whom wisdom should help insulate her to a far greater extent than someone like a Daniel Radcliffe or an Emma Watson, who are still mm-hmm. pretty young in yeah. the grand scheme of things. I have to give them credit for really, really standing up. Like Rupert Grint, Daniel Radcliffe, Emma Watson, and Eddie Redmayne have all come out and made a stand in support of the trans community.
And incidentally, that is the coolest last name I think.
What, Redmayne?
Yeah.
Well, I was waiting particularly to hear from him because he played a trans woman
yeah.
in a movie and he took mm-hmm. a lot of crap for it at the time. So he kind of had to say something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, getting back to the topic at hand, this gets into the portrait of Dorian Gray moment. Of the whole thing. And I know now I'm mixing metaphors. I'm jumping from it being a Horcrux to the portrait of Dorian Gray, which one could claim was where she got the idea of a Horcrux from.
Yeah, I mean, but, considering what happens at the end.
Well, yeah. And the commentary Oscar Wilde was making on that ended up being kind of prophetic because it was the mistake he made.
Mm-hmm.
That the problem is not the dirty, horrible, awful, unethical stuff that people were doing in upper crust British society. The true crime was perceived to be calling them out on it.
Yeah.
So there's a moment where I believe it's the victim's brother calls Dorian Gray out for murder. And Dorian Gray gets very offended and says, "You go too far, sir." And this is just a self-evident crime in the story. And I'm getting to this because J.K. Rowling takes incredible exception with being called a TERF. She equates being called a TERF with misogynistic slurs, the right to police her speech, and accuse her of hatred. A TERF, a lot of people don't know what this term means. It means trans-exclusionary radical feminist. Counter to what J.K. Rowling claims, TERF, the term TERF, was not created by trans activists. It was created by a trans-exclusionary radical feminist.
Yeah.
It was, we're not transphobic. We are just TERFs. We think trans people have the right to exist, just not in female spaces. And so J.K. Rowling is acting like a trans-exclusionary radical feminist. And what's interesting is later on in the piece, it seems that her big complaint is that she's not a radical feminist. The trans-exclusionary part doesn't seem to bother her as much as the idea that women are being called radical feminists.
I know.
It's like, she starts off with the dangers to young people, gay people, and about the erosion of women and girls' rights. If you are so worried about the rights of women and girls that you blow up your own life like this, that is the definition of radical.
Yeah.
That is the definition of radical feminist. You feel like extreme things have to be done because women's rights are so under threat. So, I mean, J.K. Rowling bears every mark of the definition of trans-exclusionary radical feminist.
Yeah.
She is very strident in her feminist beliefs. And there is nothing wrong with that. Radical feminist may be used as a pejorative, but, you know, a lot of people, myself included, embrace the term. You know, but she is trans-exclusionary. She does not believe that trans women are women. And, you know, she hasn't come out and said that yet. And this is one of these things a professional interviewer taught me, that when somebody's going to lie, they take a long time getting up to the lie.
Mm-hmm.
Because people try to avoid lying. And so they justify the mistruth. They justify the deception with this lengthy justification for the deception to come.
Yep.
And she gets into, Mouse, how much of this stuff should I read? Because a lot of it's quite triggering. And I don't want to upset anyone, but I want people to see what she said.
I think we could probably put a content warning, or you can summarize without going,
you know what,
I'm
going to read her words. You're right. Like, yeah. if you're feeling sensitive right now, stop, wait, feel free to hit pause, listen to this. Because I admit this is where I started to get really not just pissed off, but like bothered.
Like someone punched you in the stomach?
Yes. This is when I started to feel gut punched, because this is such a manipulative appeal to emotion of who is labeled a TERF, mm-hmm. right? In practice, a huge and diverse cross-section of women are currently being called TERFs, and the vast majority have never been radical feminists. There's the part. It's like, oh, it's the radical feminist. It's a problem. Examples of so-called TERFs range from the mother of a gay child who was afraid their child wanted to transition to escape homophobic bullying, to a hitherto totally unfeminist older woman who's vowed never to visit Marks and Spencer again because they're allowing any man who says they identify as a woman into the woman's changing room. That, again, I'm like, wow, I could have stopped six times there to point out what was wrong. But I want to show you a particularly manipulative passage. This is when you have to engage your critical thinking. The mother of a gay child who was afraid their child wanted to transition. Do you notice what's missing there?
The actual statement.
Any desire on the part of the kid to transition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's the fear.
Yeah. That jumped out at me. Not that their kid wanted to transition and they thought it was because of social pressure. A fear they feared their child wanted to transition to escape homophobic bullying. She didn't say the kid actually wanted to transition. Mm-hmm. There's this ongoing thing you'll see where she believes women will feel forced to become men. And then, you know, the second part of framing Marks and Spencer's change room policy as allowing any man who says they identify as a woman, not anyone, any man who says they identify as a woman into the woman's changing room. Now, this may sound, some people may go, well, what's wrong with that? That's not what the policy says. What the policy means is people are allowed to use the change room they feel identifies with their gender. It puts the employees who are usually making minimum wage out of the really unfortunate position of having to gender card non-passing trans people. Mm-hmm. Like put yourself in the position of somebody working at Marks and Spencer, right? A person comes up that looks kind of mannish to you. What are you supposed to do when they want to try on a dress? Excuse me, ma'am, are you a woman?
Yeah.
That's, you're trying to sell clothes. You don't sell clothes to people you're offending. Mm-hmm. You know? And I go shopping with friends of mine who do drag. It's actually a real issue. Because they want to try on pants, because that's one of the hardest things for drag performers to find pants that actually look decent and fit.
Right.
Unless you've got sort of those change room rules, they have to buy the stuff, take it home, try it on, and take it back if they don't fit, which serves no one, right?
Right.
People, there is not a scourge of people lurking in change rooms to molest women, Donald Trump aside.
Yeah.
Like that's one of the things that I find most intellectually offensive about this argument. This thing she claims our current rules are protecting against, well, they're not. We all know that infamous story of the writer who Donald Trump, she accused Donald Trump of kind of cajoling her into a change room to try some stuff on, saying he wanted a gift for his wife, and then, mm-hmm. you know, sexually assaulting her in the change room. This stuff still happens if a guy is powerful and connected enough. Most people, I tried to show something to my husband once at a Victoria's Secret and they threw him out of the change room. And it's like, he's not looking at anybody else. I'm asking him his opinion on something that primarily affects him. I find the rules really, really stupid, personally. But that was the Victoria's Secret in Beverly Hills. I should be clear at the Beverly Center. It's funny because we don't have these issues up here. Men kind of stand up at the edge of the change room. They put a chair for men where we are. This is not an issue in Canada in a lot of places, but I'm digressing just because that part frustrates me. So
well, there's a paint. It's also painted. The way she framed one of the reasons why I was bothered by this, and I thought that there was something very, very fishy going on, is this is, like I mentioned to you on chat, a good part of this sounds like it was written by an old white male Republican.
The minute you mention Marks and Spencer, it immediately dates you as old. Okay,
yeah. but I mean. Outside of the fact that we had a similar, you know, we had similar cases of someone writing something like this to try and incite panic about trans men and women, basically, or people masquerading as trans men and women, sneaking into a bathroom or a changing room to molest you. Doesn't that sound like a little bit like the gay panic from the 80s?
I think that's
why. If you allow your children, they will.
I think that's why I admit. I think that's why I had such a bad reaction to it.
It is because they'll say, oh no, if you let gays teach in schools, then you'll have teachers molesting your children, and you will have
men pretending to be gay to get close to women.
Yeah, and yeah. PE teachers abusing, you know, girls.
Oh, that's right. The lesbian gym teacher stereotype.
The lesbian gym teacher stereotype.
Yeah.
So it's so.
It's the barbarians at the gate.
It's the
nonsense.
Barbarians at the gate. Yeah. And see, this always happens with people who in one way or another exist in a liminal state within a society. Because in the view of people in the 80s and 90s, gay and lesbian, men and women, weren't, in, you know, according to the wording of quite a few of them, weren't, and many people still feel this way today, they weren't really men or really women. Mm-hmm. They were somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. So if they didn't fit in this section or in this other, then they were a threat. Mm-hmm. They were basically the unknown. And
the lavender menace. It's right
the
in
lavender, the name. The lavender menace. So of course, you know, now that gay men and women are more accepted, trans people haven't had that happen to them. They're still right. One of the most endangered demographics in that spectrum. You know, the life expectancy is about 35 years old. It's like we're in the goddamn Middle Ages.
Especially if you're a black trans woman.
Especially if you're a black trans woman.
Yeah.
So of course, now that Ellen is on prime time and
Rachel Maddow
what's his
Janelle
Anderson
Monáe's
Cooper.
Kissing women in Homecoming and like Supergirl Legends of Tomorrow. You can't find a CW show without lesbians.
I know. And you got, you know, Anderson Cooper,
Don Lemon.
You've got all of the liminal menace that used to be part of that demographic has shifted over to the more vulnerable, less represented, more maligned trans population. So of course, they are the chameleons now. They are the ones who are not one thing or another, and they're here to endanger you. And they're the Trojan horse others will use to endanger you as well.
What kicks my ass is that, you know, Jake, the lesbians that J.K. Rowling is citing in this are doing exactly the same thing to trans people that feminists like Betty Friedan did to lesbian women during second wave feminism.
Oh yeah.
And that pisses me off because if you're an activist, okay, you can be an activist and be an idiot, okay? But if you are an activist, you have a certain responsibility to be educated and to know your history and to not make the same damn mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, don't Agreed. Be, you know, if Nintendo had remembered what Atari did to Nintendo that made them get into consoles, mm-hmm. they wouldn't have done the same thing to Sony presenting, you know, creating the PlayStation and their primary competition that almost put them out of business.
Yeah.
Like, this is just not a survival trait, as well as ignorant and stupid and lazy. And let's face it, downright mean. This has been the history of social change. You see it in race as well. You know, when the Irish became, as you put it, liminally white, like on the edges of whiteness, mm-hmm. and you know, American Jews to a certain extent, they punch down, right? They show their association with whiteness by picking on people less white than them. Mm-hmm. There's a great song in the musical Ragtime, really, really underrated musical. Ragtime.
It is. It
I don't
really
know
is.
Why. Good music, but also makes a point. You know the baseball song?
Yes.
It's just all horrible racial slurs and then what a game. Like, it's brilliant satirical writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that sort of encapsulates the way waves of marginalization work in America. And apparently Britain, because Britain, the struggle isn't so much race, it's class.
Yes. I always found that a little bit fascinating.
Well, it's interesting because there's race, but there's also, I mean, Britain is a country that just changed their monarchical rules of succession to be egalitarian before Prince George was born, like William and Kate's son.
Mm-hmm.
So that says something about Britain, and that says something about the particular role of women, like Victoria and Elizabeth I and Elizabeth II. They all ruled just because there were no men left.
Yeah.
and that has to do something to a psyche. And I'm only I'm only doing this tangent right now to, I guess, be a little bit Hillelian to show that I understand J.K. Rowling's perspective on this, because it's about to get pretty brutal right now. She is so aggressive in her statements. There is no way to refute her without seeming aggressive. Mm-hmm. And then she can go, "See, you're attacking me. I'm a victim."
Yes.
Drives me friggin' crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a false cause fallacy. Yeah. You know, she's claiming she's reacting to attacks when
she generates.
Yes. Yes. She creates these conditions. And instead of just going, "Oh, I didn't know that element of the case," she seems allergic to admitting she's wrong.
Yeah, it's poking the beehive and then condemning the bees.
And I believe she didn't know the dirtier elements of the Maya Forstater case. I was trying to avoid talking about this, but this is the woman J.K. Rowling defended who she claims got fired for tweets.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't. She was a contract worker. Her contract wasn't renewed. She sued, not the other way around. The reason her contract was not renewed was not because of her tweets. It's because she pretty much said she was going to gender people based on what she thought they were, as opposed to their gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that in Britain. You can't do that in Canada. U.S., well, we'll see. Unfortunately, the jury's out right now, which is why it's so important to talk about this right now and to show the lack of logic. This isn't a kumbaya hug it out statement that we're taking right now, guys. We're not doing this to be good people. We're saying this because we're offended by the poor logic inherent in this. So let's move on, because now we're finally at should I skip the being called a TERF has a chilling effect argument?
Yeah, that's more of an appeal to emotion. We don't really need to go into it because we've covered it. But
there's a bunch of straw men in it too. The people who argue the clownfish prove humans aren't a dimorphic species. That's a straw man.
Yeah,
like those aren't the people that are saying you're a TERF. Oh, it's also the part where she says, ironically, radical feminists aren't even trans exclusionary. They include trans men in their feminism because they were born women. I've read four different published pieces, and like the turnaround there is incredibly fast, written by trans men who are like, "That's nice. You think we're women, J.K. Rowling. We're not women." Like, the fact that she is so far gone, she doesn't realize there's a problem in Western society of using femininity as an insult directed at men.
Yeah.
But that, that statement, do you want to tackle this? Do we need to unpack this? Like,
you tell me if this is an accurate reductio ad absurdum.
Yeah.
This.
Okay.
The Catholic League, the atheist movement is a pro-Catholic movement because within its ranks it contains people who were born into Catholic families.
I actually had somebody argue that on the abortion issue this week.
Really?
Yes. Yes. That the pro-life movement is not a religious movement because some atheists are part of it too.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
These are the times we're living in. I firmly believe that, you know, it isn't the Mayan calendar or anything like that. 2020 is effed because people have gotten stupid.
I think so too.
Or rather,
more stupid people have means of communication.
Well, the symbol of 2020 for me was what happened over the weekend, where a guy got shot by the cops at a Wendy's parking lot after being asleep in his car. So yeah. People burned down the Wendy's. Like, that's a metaphor.
Yeah.
For our world right now. Like, and it's kind of funny in a dark way, but it's just so poetic for me. That's what J.K. Rowling's doing right now, right? A bunch of people decided to be not nice to her on this particular issue, so she decided to burn down the issue.
That's a very accurate way of putting it.
Like, that's what she's doing. She's burning it all down. And that, like, you want to talk about white, straight, cisgender privilege here, guys. That line, is it right there? That, oh, radical feminists aren't even trans exclusionary. They include trans men in their feminism. That is just such a privileged piece of stupid.
Yes.
And
yes, it is.
The only way you can't see that as dumb is it's the same way that certain feminists like rarefied air feminists like Gloria Steinem talk down about sex workers because they're in salons with only other women who feel the same way. And they talk about sex workers as some sort of subspecies, as opposed to men and women doing honest work that deserve dignity. And oh no, they're helping. They're helping you. You don't tend to help someone you see as an equal.
Yeah.
You stand up for a person you see as an equal. You help the less fortunate. It's alms for the poor thinking, right? And this is not a logical fallacy. It just sort of shows the root of the logical fallacy.
Yeah, it's the attitude that makes that logical fallacy possible.
Yeah. So now we get into the five reasons. That was all preamble, folks.
God have mercy on our souls.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like the Assassin's Creed 3 of essays. If you don't know why I referenced that. Assassin's Creed 3 is like a 35-hour game and it's 10 hours of tutorial.
Yes.
So we're out of the tutorial now, folks. Okay. We've she's given us the tools to buy into her BS. But now, and I'm sure Mouse, you're gonna chew this apart. Because whenever someone gives a number, whenever somebody creates a list, critical thinking ears perk up. We go, bink, okay, something we can actually debate. You know?
Yeah.
Hard points. Here we go. So five reasons for being worried about the new trans activism, which is new trans activism, trying to distinguish it from the old trans activism, I guess. It sounds to me like she's had a problem with this for a while, so she doesn't define what makes this new. But okay, I'm going to read the reasons, and I'm going to let you respond to them, okay, Mouse?
Oh, God.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I know it's painful. I know it's painful. Deep breaths, everybody. Like, just deep breaths. Okay. Okay. Channel Ayn Rand. You have no emotion. Okay. There is objective reality. And I want you to use that as a cornerstone. Okay. There is objective reality. Because what comes next is going to try to persuade you that there is no such thing, that there is only subjective reality informed by fear. Okay. Firstly, I have a charitable trust. Oh, what a lot. Okay, I shouldn't embroider. I'm sorry. It's so hard. First, I have a charitable trust.
Let's make this a tag team kind of thing, because this is gonna be. I don't think you're gonna be able to hold back.
No, I'm gonna try. I'm gonna be professional here and not embroider it with my disgust. I have a charitable trust that focuses on alleviating social deprivation in Scotland with. Sorry, I love that it's Scotland because of the no true Scotsman fallacy.
Like,
she was born in Bristol. She's English. And she's referring to Scotland. It's just too perfect. But I go on. With a particular emphasis on women and children. I'll reread that. Alleviating social deprivation in Scotland with a particular emphasis on women and children. Among other things, my trust supports projects for female prisoners and for survivors of domestic and sexual abuse. I also fund research into MS, a disease that behaves very differently in men and women. It's been clear to me for a while that the new trans activism is having, or is likely to have, if all its demands are met, a significant impact on many of the causes I support because it's pushing to erode the legal definition of sex and replace it with gender. That's it. That's her entire first point.
Dear Lord.
Yeah. Where do you start?
Well,
it's special pleading. First of all, she's created so many exceptions.
Yes.
The minute you disprove her wrong on one point, she can jump to something else.
Yes. There. She has packed this with so many. Well, first of all, that first paragraph, the argument has the same direction as a pack of firecrackers. It's just it's all over the place. But you've got, so you have here an appeal to you have an appeal to emotion.
That is anecdotal.
That is anecdotal. And then outside of the special pleading, you also have an appeal to authority because, you know, she, this is, it's, I know you're not supposed to read into someone's mind, but you have to look at how the paragraph is composed.
Yes. You're not reading into her mind. You're reading into her words.
Yes. And the words are sort of propping up a certain level of saintly victimhood here. You know, it is creating the statement. She really cares about this. She is involved in this, which, you know, every time someone tries to build that up, there is always the tacit question. Therefore, who are you to question what I'm doing?
Yeah, it's an adapted, loaded question. She's such a good person that challenging her means you're a bad person.
Yes, it's back to the poisoning of the well. You know, so many good, kind, decent people have told me they feel exactly the way I do, which is a very roundabout way to saying, yeah, I'm such a good person, y'all.
Well, it's also a composition division fallacy, right? Yeah. Because even if there might be issues into medical research and mm-hmm. diseases that behave differently in men and women, that doesn't make that particular element relevant to anything else she's talking about.
Correct. And it, you know, it does create the whole, well, if any of you criticize me, then you're not part of, again, the divisive, you're not part of that nice group of sensitive, educated people.
Yeah.
You're screaming at me on the internet and being a mean person.
Well, she's also using ambiguity and reverse burden of proof as a tag team because she's not offering any proof for what she's saying. She's making a very emotionally charged statement, leaving it there, and basically insisting that somebody prove her wrong.
Yeah, she's creating a floating abstraction.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah. Using a lot of cherry-picked information that just gets into this mess, which is exactly like her writing. She world builds only so much that any mistake she makes, well, it's kind of possible. There are exceptions to every magical rule. You know, let's spend four books teaching people that exact pronunciation in your spell is essential. It goes horribly wrong. And now we're going to introduce silent casting. That's all about the intent.
Yeah.
Like this is, she writes logic the way she writes magic. Messy. You know,
I mean, I think we can stop the podcast right now because I think you've just encapsulated everything about J.K. Rowling with that phrase. I'm kidding about stopping the podcast, but I really do think that in many cases J.K. Rowling does not in fact understand logic.
Well, she doesn't, right? J.K. Rowling is an amalgamist. She took a bunch of sources for her book. Dickens, heavily Dickens, but a bunch of other stuff. The Gormenghast trilogy, heavily. If you're sick of J.K. Rowling and want to read Harry Potter that is basically done by an actual person with schizophrenia, read the Gormenghast trilogy.
Oh, God, Gormenghast, yes.
Oh, I love it because it's so messy and it's so raw and it's so authentic and it's like, what? But you'll see a lot. There are parts that are just flat out cribbed from Gormenghast, including Dumbledore and Snape.
Yeah.
That's basically, and the teacher, the ghost teacher is basically Dedion from Gormenghast. She ripped it off like it was shameless. But because she's just borrowing from various sources, she doesn't truly understand how all of them fit together. Compare that to a writers who also deal with magic, like Terry Pratchett or Alan Moore, as cantankerous and surly as Alan Moore is. Those writers understand the structure and intent of what they're doing.
Yes.
It is cohesive to the point that it's inexcusable that the adaptations, other than Good Omens, which was excellent, that the adaptations have been so bad. There's no reason you can't adapt Terry Pratchett or Alan Moore well, as long as you understand the why of what they're doing.
Well, Rihanna Pratchett's on that, so.
Yes, we're holding out for Rihanna. We have hope. We have hope. Rihanna will save us all. Though, like I said, Neil Gaiman did an okay job too. And he has a lot of the flaws that J.K. Rowling has as a writer as well. But I'm digressing. Yes. Let's move on to point two. All right, here we are. The second reason is that I'm an ex-teacher and the founder of a children's charity, which gives me an interest in both education and safeguarding. Like many others, I have deep concerns about the effect that trans rights movement is having on both. Okay, Dolores Umbridge.
Yeah.
That's my response to that. I'm a former teacher and I care. I have done good things for people.
I have to be honest, and this I know can be and considered an emotional reaction, but I am infinitely wary and suspicious of any one person who uses their credentials as a former teacher to spearhead a movement and doesn't really... Let me put it this way. I have met a great deal of sanctimonious, holier-than-thou, knows-in-your-lives people who have claimed, who have held their teacher credentials high for everyone to see. And in many, many, many cases, they believe that those credentials give them a special insight.
Well, didn't she also write 7 books about a school where a lot of the teachers were utterly terrible?
Terrible, yes. But here's, that gives them a certain insight and a greater wisdom than you in order to handle these things. I'm so freaking sorry, but there's a great deal of goddamn really shitty teachers out there.
Well, it's the professional equivalent of, I'm sorry, do you have children?
Yeah, it's a Karen thing. I'm sorry, do you have children?
It's credentialist Karening.
Yeah, it's credentialist Karening. And I'm sorry, but I don't care if you were a teacher. I care if you were a good teacher.
Yes.
And that is not proven to me, but say by for example, by how long you were employed, because we know, for example, in the United States, we have a great deal of terrible teachers who are employed and can't be fired because of the union.
Yeah.
And teachers who have even had molestation charges placed against them who can't be fired.
Mm-hmm. She also, from a point of form, she actually rewords the same point twice.
Yeah.
And makes them different points.
Mm-hmm.
She said that she has a charitable trust that, you know, dot, 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 particular emphasis on children. And then she says she's a founder of a children's charity. She's referring to the same entity. There's only so many charities a person can run. She's splitting something and claiming it's 2 points when she's really just making the same point twice.
And here's the thing. This is something that always sticks in my craw, because she's using charity as a moral... as a moral blank check.
And well, it's the Trump organization fallacy,
yeah,
right?
Here's the thing. There's a problem. Okay, take a shot. Ayn Rand. So Ayn Rand's objection to people considering charity a moral obligation is that, of course, it not only does it compel you, does it create a compelling a force for you to get involved in any charity because you should give to charity. And that's something that should be entirely voluntary. This is, she did not discard charities. The people often misrepresent that. She did not discard charities. In fact, she gave to charities anonymously, herself, anonymously. But she disliked the point that many people considered it a moral obligation. Because, you know, not only did it create this compulsion, you must give to charity, but then the people who gave to charity sort of created this investiture upon them of virtue that many, many times they would use as a bludgeon.
Well, yeah, I also went full Ayn Rand on somebody today when it came to the idea of charity and the right to discriminate. If you just want to give money to something, if you want to help particular people, and you don't register as, you know, a nonprofit for tax purposes, if you just want to set up a corporation to do whatever the F you want, that's your money.
Yeah.
You can, it's the baker that refused to bake cakes for gay weddings. That is protected. You can do that.
Yep.
It's when you become essentially an arm's length government entity that these human rights kick in. You cannot get tax benefits from your charitable giving and discriminate.
Right, so because government is not allowed to discriminate.
That's right. So if J.K. Rowling feels so strongly about this, she can drop the nonprofit status and pay tax on her money. That's all she has to do. The right to spend her money the way she wants it is not under threat.
Yeah.
And then, so let's go to the third. The third.
We're almost there, people.
Maybe. This is like the Harry Potter series. As we get closer to the end, the books get longer.
And more insane.
Yeah. The third is that, as a much banned author, I'm interested in freedom of speech and have publicly defended it, even onto Donald Trump. First of all, much banned author? You know? Yes, her book was banned by a few Christian organizations early on. But the idea that a woman who, what is it, 10 movies? And 2 theme parks now?
And a freaking castle? I mean, Enya has a castle, but...
just look at the proliferation. It's the opposite of banning. Yeah. Harry Potter has become such a cultural touchstone. It's like Star Wars. She has lost control over it. The fan base believes to own it.
Yeah, but, I mean, honestly, you cannot say I'm a banned author... And then you basically are sitting on a pile of money inside your castle. A banned author is someone who... Okay, I'm going to give you the perfect example of a banned author. Mikhail Bulgakov.
Who Russian, exactly?
Russian writer who wrote a brilliant satirical take on Faust called Master and Margarita.
Yes.
That man... basically had his entire career destroyed in the Soviet regime. He could not publish his book there, and the book became famous after he died, if I recall correctly.
Or even books like Huckleberry Finn or To Kill a Mockingbird that are being struck down, not being allowed to taught in schools anymore because of one word that was included because of the punch of the word.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, J.K., you are not banned.
Yeah.
Some Christian organizations might get nervous because you have witchcraft in your books, but you are not banned.
Yeah. Florida is still very much on the edge of the Bible Belt
in
the U.S. Not one theme park. 2. The only reason anybody goes to Universal Studios anymore because of freaking Harry Potter Land or the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. Spare me.
And the Ghostbusters ride, the Ghostbusters show.
Yeah.
That was really good.
the Ghostbusters show?
Yeah.
That's not there anymore.
Oh, then screw that. Then never mind.
Exactly. So the Men in Black ride's pretty good.
Okay.
Men in Black ride's pretty good. But, okay, like, J.K. Rowling referring to herself as a much banned author is just freaking absurd. And to bring Donald Trump, I think this is the first time anybody's ever used Donald Trump as a shield.
I know.
Especially since you're bringing to mind the guy who actually probably did rape a woman in a change room.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know.
Allegedly.
It's like trying to tell somebody to listen to the Humpty Dance and not think about Burger King. Right? Oh. What's the first line you think of? I once got busy in a Burger King bathroom. Sorry, that was a little too my childhood for a lot of people on this podcast. I apologize. Okay, the fourth, we're getting punchy. We're getting giddy because it's so absurd.
It is kind of a, and I'm sorry, JK, you don't defend Donald Trump's freedom. Nobody needs to defend Donald Trump's freedom of speech. The dude is president.
Well, that much banned author thing is, in a way, that no true Scotsman, the appeal to purity.
Yeah.
Right? I know what it's like to be persecuted. No, you don't.
No, you don't.
Like, that's like Stephanie Meyer saying she's persecuted because she's Mormon. Like, freaking
spam. No, no, no. No, that's like Stephanie Meyer. That's like Stephanie Meyer claiming to be persecuted because people keep writing gay/fics of her vampire and werewolf.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. Well, that's the weird thing, that there's a lot of Harry Potter drag shows. I've been to one. Like, I saw a Harry Potter drag show where they had, like, the drag performers were dressed up like Ron and Harry, and that had a puppet as Hermione. You can imagine where that puppet went.
Oh, God.
But, like, this is why it touched us such a nerve, right? Because there is this sort of extended fan base, because she created a world in which, you know, there are evidence that men can have female souls, but also the Polyjuice potion means your body can be anything you want it to be. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, this was really dumb for her to wade into, but she doesn't understand her own work because she is, to an extent, a plagiarist. But that was harsh. That was harsh. I take that back. She borrows. She's heavily inspired.
She's playing with the better ideas of better authors.
Yes. Yes. So the fourth is where things start to get truly personal. Being a much banned author, an ex-teacher, and the founder of a children's charity. That wasn't about her. Okay. Yeah. This is the point. I said that, not her. This is a point where things get truly personal. I'm concerned about the huge explosion in young women wishing to transition, and also about the increasing numbers who seem to be detransitioning, returning to their original sex, because they regret taking steps that have, in some cases, altered their bodies irrevocably and taken away their fertility. Some say they decided to transition after realizing they were same-sex attractive and that transitioning was partially driven by homophobia, either in society or in other families. No evidence offered.
No articles cited, no studies cited.
She pulled a Donald Trump.
People
are saying, or no one knew, that thing Trump tends to do?
Yeah.
Most people probably aren't aware, she continues. I certainly wasn't until I started researching this issue properly. That 10 years ago, the majority of people wanting to transition to the opposite sex were male. That ratio has now reversed. The UK has experienced a 4,400% increase in girls being referred to transitioning treatment. Autistic girls are hugely overrepresented in their numbers. These things are as real as Harry Potter spells. This is not there. Yes, there has been an increase in interest in transition, the same way there was an increase in people coming out when acceptance of gay people became more common.
Yeah, it's here's the thing. I read this, and you know what I think about? I think of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad saying, "Oh no, there's no gay people in Iran. There's no gay people in Iran. There are. You just don't give them the freedom to be gay."
Yeah. Yep.
Because you kill them. But
yep. Yeah. Like, the whole concept of homosexuality wasn't even a term until, what was it, like the 1950s?
Yeah. Prior to that, it was, you had the euphemistic words like, not terribly euphemistic, kind of slightly insulted, such as inverted or Uranist, which was a little better for Uranus. Uranus. Yes.
Yeah.
They did not intend for it to be a pun, by the way. For people listening,
the planet Uranus, right?
Yeah.
There were. It wasn't really considered an issue, because whatever you did before you got married, well, that's all well and good.
Yeah.
You know, marriage among the working classes, well, who cared? Because nothing was inherited. Mm. All that mattered is you married into a proper family and
consolidated your power.
Right. And maybe you cheated on them like crazy, like so many people did. But the point is, you had a good match on paper.
Yeah. And you tried to get rid of that entailment.
Yeah, this wasn't an issue until basically we had the development of the middle class. Wealth could be created because it wasn't inherited. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of a sudden, people could own things. The only reason we have gay rights is we have a gay designation. And the only reason we really have a gay designation is because of capitalism. Uh-huh. It's kind of a messed up thing, but that's a topic for another time. So I'll skip a lot of the anecdotal, very emotionally charged stuff.
And a little note here, people, if you ever write an article, hopefully not like this, but when you when you're making claims of this size and of this import, you really should cite your sources. And if you can't cite a source, then that should give you pause.
Well, do you notice she's quite happy to name drop when it suits her?
Mm-hmm.
But then she drops a ridiculous statistic, like a 4,400%. Like, that's like, you know, increase your ejaculate 687%. It's a number pulled out of nowhere.
Exactly.
And then the reference to autistic girls being overrepresented. Like, she provides no source. And then later on, you know, later on in the next few paragraphs, she happily references certain people by name.
Yeah.
It's messy. And, you know,
it's manipulative is what it is.
It's manipulative, but it's also kind of funny because if you look at her five reasons, they're sort of structured the same way that her book writing is. The first is fairly okay organized. It's fluffy. It's not the greatest thing in the world, but it's a reasonable length and it's fairly well constructed.
Mm-hmm.
Second one, shorter, but still decent. Third one, really freaking abbreviated. Fourth, bloated mess. It's exactly the way the Harry Potter series went. She has this habit. She's one of those people who likes beginnings because they make her feel important.
Mm-hmm.
That's a supposition. She likes endings because they make her feel in control. But getting there, the middle part, a lot of authors really aren't big on the middle because that's where you feel most powerless as a creator.
Which is why so many writing coaches always suggest start at the middle.
See, I need an ending. I need to know where I'm going.
Where are you going?
Yeah, because like, otherwise I become George Martin and meander for 12 years. Like, you know, I'm not guiding the Jews through the desert. Okay. I just want to write a book.
Suddenly I just had the soundtrack for Exodus.
There you go. I'll skip. Like she references psychiatrists and anecdotal stuff. And whether she wonders if she'd transitioned if she'd been born 30 years earlier, which is actually, I think, the crux of the issue for her. Mm. She's a bit dysphoric herself and can't even right now. But the part that really killed me in this part, before we jump to the last one, because we're running out of time, and we can't split our last section into two movies the way Harry Potter did.
Ooh.
She references Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah.
And this was the part where I almost flipped the table. Like, I almost went, no! I went, Jesus and the moneylenders. Like, Gandalf, you shall not pass.
Well, did you notice that, in a way, her quoted passage contradicts and stands
absolutely
in contradiction of the spirit of her entire article?
Absolutely. Simone de Beauvoir's most famous phrase is, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. And she originally wrote in French. It uses the gender neutral third person pronoun, on. You know, on, one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I do not, you do not, he does not, she do not. One does not. Singular of they, right?
Mm-hmm.
Singular second person. So Simone de Beauvoir's quote, the J.K. Rowling, and the whole point is you're not born a woman. It's a series of social constructs right. that are you know, establishes womanhood.
And for those who are looking for it, the quote is the one that begins, on ne n'est pas femme, on le devient.
Yeah. Yeah. One is not, you know, I guess one does not begin, one becomes is actually is the exact literal translation of it. But she says in English translation, it is perfect. This is what J.K. Rowling uses in her Horcrux blog, okay? It is perfectly natural for the future woman to feel indignant at the limitations imposed upon her by her sex. The real question is not why she should reject them. The problem is rather to understand why she accepts them. Why does J.K. Rowling think this backs her up instead of invalidating her entire thesis?
Yeah, that's the first thing I noticed.
Like, if one is a future woman, it means they are not a woman yet. Mm-hmm. Meaning, and what she's basically saying is the acceptance of womanhood is a choice. Because she says the real question is not why she should reject them, which is an opt out. The problem is rather to understand why she accepts them, why she opts in. Mm-hmm. De Beauvoir is saying gender is a choice.
Yeah.
And I mean, Simone de Beauvoir was deeply uncomfortable with femininity and disgusted by physical reproduction. So I'm going to skip through her attempts to glad hand her transition will be a solution for some gender dysphoric people. That line pissed me off because if transition cannot be a solution if she does not accept the transition.
Yeah. And I have a quick musing. Do you think that in maybe some recess of her mind, she is bothered by the implications of this quote? The Simone de Beauvoir code, and she's just trying to exorcise it out of her life.
Well, she did use a gender neutral pen name.
Yeah. Robert Galbraith.
Yeah. J.K. Rowling. She didn't use Joanne Rowling.
That's true.
She fashioned herself after J.M. Barrie. You know, I'll skip because we don't have the time. Because where's the fifth reason? Like, the fourth reason is three times as long as all the other reasons combined. Just like the fourth Harry Potter book was longer than the first three combined.
Yeah.
The fifth reason, she's deeply concerned about the consequences of the current trans activism is, I'll summarize, she's a domestic abuse and sexual assault survivor. That has nothing to do with the trans question. But what that is a shorthand for saying, this bothers me because men are violent. And remember that meme that Donald Trump Jr. spread about the bowl of Skittles?
Yeah.
Remember that? That if there's one poison Skittle in the bowl of Skittles, would you eat the Skittles? That's this argument. That's what she's floating here. That, of course, she says, I'm mentioning these things now not in an attempt to garner sympathy, but out of solidarity with the huge numbers of women who have histories like mine, who have been slurred as bigots for having concerns around single-sex spaces. It is the bowl of Skittles argument.
It is. And she's being disingenuous because she is using this as a way to bolster her other arguments and in a way, you know,
As opposed to what a good opinion writer like George Orwell did, where he's like, I'm an anti-Semite. Can someone please help me understand why?
Mm-hmm.
If she came up and said, yeah, I'm a transphobe and here's why. I think this is a legitimate point of view, even though I admit, yeah, you people scare me. That would have been a more productive form of writing.
Yeah.
Like that would have led somewhere useful. This doesn't, because she's equating trans women with men and men as inherent predators and women as default victims. And so we must keep anything male or male adjacent out. Meanwhile, we must not lose anyone woman or woman adjacent. Because we are doing them a disservice, letting them out, the poor sheep, in a world full of wolves.
It is such a compact package deal that she has created there, where she has essentially created, it's amazing because she has created one narrow point as the victim and everybody else as either predators or predator enablers simply by existing.
Or she relates to people who have been the victims of transmisogynistic violence as kin of a sort. You know, they're liminal in their world, or marginalized, as a lot of people say. I like the word liminal better. But, you know, she's acting as a sorting hat. Sorting people into predator, Slytherin, prey, Hufflepuff. Mm-hmm. Defenders of those prey, Gryffindor, and bystanders, Ravenclaw.
That's a... Well done.
I've spent way too much time analyzing Harry Potter from a perspective like this, because I really, really wanted to understand why people liked it so much. Because I was like, I read this and go, this makes me want to go back and read Dickens, Terry Pratchett, and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, me too. I was never one of those who jumped on the Harry Potter bandwagon. I took, you know, I have read all of the books, but over the course of like 10 years, because after every book, I had to go, okay, I need a break now. I'm going to go back to Terry Pratchett and Lord Dunsany. And
I read them to have something I could talk to my mother about, because we don't have a lot of things in common, and she was really into it. And it was a way to get her off talking about Sense and Sensibility.
Oh, gosh. which I love. I love. But there's only so much you can talk about.
The only way I can handle Jane Austen is if Emma Thompson directs, because she understands that it is brutal satire, not a romance. But right, we are digressing here.
All of it is... So much of her work is supposed to be satire and poking at the status quo.
Brutal, but it's, vicious.
But it's done so elegantly
that
it goes over the head of a lot of people.
Yeah. But so getting back to what's a real issue about J.K. Rowling's bowl of Skittles fifth point. This is the same argument used to deny gay people the ability to give blood, even with, you know, accurate and readily available testing for HIV. And the reason children and adults alike are languishing in cages on the U.S. border right now.
Yeah.
The argument, if even one slips through, it is too many. That is what she is arguing here. I was harmed. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're
raping
rapists,
our women.
And some, I assume, are good people.
Yeah.
This is her argument. That's why I think you sort of instinctively went, she sounds like a conservative, because she's hitting those fear and disgust buttons the way conservatives do, because, you know, we know that people are more likely to identify and vote conservative if they have a very high, they have a very low disgust threshold, meaning things disgust them. They're they're more likely to describe something as disgusting when it is in fact just peculiar or novel.
Right. And also when their fear reflect has been triggered.
That's right. That's right. But there is nothing different, absolutely nothing different than J.K. Rowling saying that she's deeply concerned about trans activism because she's a domestic abuse survivor, to Donald Trump Jr.'s bowl of Skittles analogy and Donald Trump's excuse for not just keeping out, but actively oppressing thousands of Latin American brown people. Mexico's not part of Latin America, but apparently a lot of them aren't Mexican. They're people that came through Mexico from El Salvador and places like that, Honduras.
Right. So much of that is also Stephen Miller. The majority of that is Stephen Miller. Yeah. Trump is not intelligent enough to actually have a policy of his own.
Yeah. But it's all the bowl of Skittles.
Yeah, it's the bowl of Skittles.
And J.K. Rowling, first of all, leverages her gender in a deeply misogynistic way. That I've always found J.K. Rowling's attitudes extremely sexist.
Uh-huh.
And I've taken a lot of crap for saying, no, Harry Potter's a sexist book.
I mean, think about it, for example, very, very briefly. So the one of the perhaps the only character I really like in Harry Potter is, of course, a character whose template he took from a better author, Minerva McGonagall, who's really Granny Weatherwax.
Yeah, she's Granny Weatherwax. She's Granny Weatherwax.
The who technically has the potential to be the strongest female character in any book.
Yep.
I will defend to with many, many arguments that Granny Weatherwax is one of the best moral heroines in modern fantasy.
Oh, she is. For people who don't know Granny Weatherwax, if you played a BioWare game, Kreia, I always mispronounce her name, from Knights of the Old Republic, or Flemeth from the Dragon Age games, they're based on a Granny Weatherwax archetype. Like, mm-hmm. BioWare borrows from a lot of sources. That's where that snarky crone archetype comes from, is Granny Weatherwax. Mm-hmm.
But also driven by the steam engine of what they consider morally right. And yes. being very careful as to what they determine as being morally right, yep. not trampling on other people's freedom or predestining them for something.
Yeah.
But look at what J.K. Rowling does with Minerva McGonagall. In the first book, she appears as a strong force character. And as the series progresses, she disappears.
Well, she's the tough but fair teacher.
Yeah.
Well, worse, she doesn't just disappear. She finally becomes headmistress
mm-hmm.
at half of Dumbledore's age.
Yeah.
How about she retires after a few years?
Yeah.
That pissed me off. Also, Harry becomes an Auror, and I think Ron goes to Ron just seems like he's so beta that he doesn't realize that, like, dude, your best friend married your sister. He's totally into you. But also Hermione just ends up in middle management.
Yeah, she becomes a bureaucrat.
She's so exceptional. And she ends up, she should have been Minister for Magic by the end.
Like, or a researcher, like one of the top magic researchers.
Yeah, I mean, Harry and Ron should have been like...
middle management.
We would not be alive were it not for her. She got us out of more scrapes than I can count. So, she, all the Hermione, all the things. But also, do you notice that J.K. Rowling had... Ginny Weasley take a year off dating Harry to go play women's sports?
Yeah.
Wow, that's an indicator of something.
Yeah.
Ask any female athlete. There's a lot of lesbians and females. And she comes back and is like, okay, sure.
Whatever.
Like, there is something very, and I guess the unresolved abuse is the explanation for why. I mean, God, the most openly heroic thing any woman does in a Harry Potter book is let herself be killed. And like, we all thought that J.K. Rowling's self-insert in the book was Hermione, but I think it's actually Lily Evans.
She's
trying to reclaim that somehow. Like, oh no, it was an act of protection. Like, what? Huh? You know? And then you find out that Lily Evans was actually kind of an unforgiving snot
who
went with the bully. Like, there's so much. I don't like psychoanalyzing authors, but it's much easier to psychoanalyze a bad author. And I think that, I mean, this Horcrux essay certainly shows that J.K. Rowling is not a great writer. She's certainly not a good logician.
Yeah.
And this is a bit of my issue with the way we handle children's literature as larks or parents wanting it to be frivolous. Because you don't want your kids being given sort of their rules for life by damaged, dumb people.
Yeah.
You want your kids being given rules for life by, you know, every artist has their quirks. But, you know, C.S. Lewis was nothing if not principled.
Yeah.
The same with J.R.R. Tolkien. I mean, I think J.R.R. Tolkien accidentally did more for to overcome toxic masculinity just by identifying with Isaac, the passive patriarch, in his own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Alice in Wonderland. There's a reason that book resonates with people.
Yeah.
because
it's a primer on how to, it's Alice in Wonderland is a primer on how to think by showing you logical fallacies at work.
Because Lewis Carroll was using algebraic nonsense. Mm-hmm. He was using makeup words as structure, because he was a mathematician. And he was showing, look, we can create a sentence out of blather that seems to make sense. But what does it mean? Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. He was a very quirky child who apparently used to make snow labyrinths.
Yeah.
It snowed.
Yeah. His mind worked in wonderfully visual ways. He was a wonderful abstractionist, but people couldn't handle the idea that the Jabberwocky poem was nothing.
Yeah.
It was nothing invoking something with placeholders. And mm-hmm. why is a raven write like a writing desk has no answer. No. But people insist on forcing an answer. And I mean, I can understand part of the reason we've sort of got where we are, because books like Harry Potter have trained people to think that you can say Expelliarmus and have it mean something.
Yeah.
What does it do? You know, but think of the power of that. You go to tons of conventions and someone will go Expelliarmus and somebody will just take whatever they have in their hand and throw it. You know, it was fun until J.K. Rowling outed herself as a very, very damaged, pretty messed up person. Mm-hmm. The core question, we don't have a lot of time to wrap up, but this is where I want to speculate, because I think we've sort of shown all the problems here. But this is what I'm struggling with, okay? Because a lot of people use success and that break they get after the first big win to better themselves. So why has this particular person decided, instead of getting help for what she calls her perennial jumpiness, that's a family joke.
Yeah, that really
does bother me. Yeah, but with all her money, she doesn't have to do anything. Why not take care of that? Why not solve that? Like, why not actually get therapy for that and be able to put that in your rear view so you can actually embrace people different from yourself? Why make that so much a part of who she is? You know, especially if she's read de Beauvoir. I mean, holy cow. Like, de Beauvoir's up there with Ayn Rand, with women who are just like, no, I'm me. And I'm not going to let the pretenses of the modern world. I mean, Simone de Beauvoir did some decidedly questionable stuff, like having mm-hmm. threesomes with Jean-Paul Sartre and her students.
Yeah.
You can't do that today. Back then, it was just considered very French.
It's true.
It's dark, but it's true. We have to wonder why people with every opportunity to not live that way anymore would rather wrap themselves in an invisibility cloak of hatred and fear, as opposed to, well, let's get beyond this.
There's many different possibilities. Some people believe, even though they speak of it as a horribly traumatic thing, many people have not really moved away from the first step, the first stage, where they believe that they did something to deserve this. Even if they their logical mind tells them, I did not do anything to deserve this, the emotional scar is still there until you treat it. And I, you know, she has shared very little of what she has done after the trauma. So I don't know what treatments she has gone through, what help she has sought.
Yeah,
but
clearly it's not working.
But it's either not working, or she's done, at a certain generation, it could be a generational thing where You know, you have people who treat mental trauma, emotional scars, mental illness as something you don't talk about, and it's something that you don't. It's the stiff upper lip.
Yeah. There could be some of that for sure.
There could be some of that, and that is, of course, it's damaging. It just festers inside you.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, and this is dark, but this might be at the core of it, is that people don't just end up in abusive relationships. People end up in abusive relationships because they lack an element of core self to begin with. Mm-hmm. That's what makes them vulnerable.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can be like worn down, that can be induced. But a big mark of abuse is that they underline your core self. You lose a sense of your identity. Unfortunately, a lot of people who come out of abuse, the abuse becomes their identity. They matter because that happened to them, as opposed to they matter because of who they are, something intrinsic. And it really seems the only thing I can logic through, and this may be my own logic mistake, is the thing that really scares J.K. Rowling about trans people is the burning, irresistible desire to identify a pretty important part of who they are, name it, stand in it, declare it, and insist people accept that about them. And it's almost like she's making that about her. There's like a jealousy of it because she's never really been able to do that.
It's something that is not uncommon with, I mean, you and I have encountered cases like this of
people, boy, have we!
yes, we have.
Yeah.
Of people with an uncertain sense of identity that feel, you know, there's a double thing at work here. Mm-hmm. It is the fact that these are liminal, you know, a liminal state of being, you know, male to female, female to male, etc., which in and of itself can be uncomfortable to someone who has trauma, and that trauma has sanded away at their core self.
Yeah.
And then seeing, as you said, these, you know, this individual claiming a core center, you know, saying, this is who I am.
Yeah. Having a this is who I am means you have some sense of objective reality, meaning some things are just true and some things are not just are not true. And ironically, that's where you hit the point, in the immortal words of Severus Snape, where you can't get away with silly wand waving, right? And J.K. Rowling wants to be accepted for a series of silly wand waving.
Yeah, and I do wonder, you know, I found it very strange that she would bring, you know, the issue of her domestic violence.
Except that's what it's really about for her.
It is.
That's what it's about.
And so, you know, that stuck out to me. And you know, it's very clear that the issue immediately triggers that emotional reaction. And, you know, she says, because of the danger of men going into, you know, men claiming that they're women and going into dressing rooms and abusing women. But I really wonder if it's just, if the whole thing is just reminding her of the trauma and reminding her of the fact that the trauma is still sitting there, that there is a scar. That she has fractured herself, or that herself has been fractured, and she hasn't. She may have thought that, you know, the work was done, or she was too afraid to do the work. Which, I mean, it happens. Facing trauma is not easy. It's harrowing. It can be. It's exhausting. It is not a happy puppy therapy session. It is not it is not, you know, it's not the fake end to Neon Genesis Evangelion where the world falls away and everybody's clapping saying congratulations. Mm-hmm. It's delving into stuff that has happened to you that has torn away parts of yourself, and it's going through the process of putting yourself back together. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is of course just my hypothesis, because
we're speculating
because we're trying to make sense of something that she posted, that she published, that raises so many flags because of the fallacies involved. But among this forest of fallacies, you have this one last argument that is just standing out. And the problem with the blog, with this Horcrux blog post, is that she hasn't said, you know, this issue triggers this in me.
Yep.
And I'm trying to understand why. Does this mean I need to look at this? No. She acknowledges that it triggers an emotional response and a trauma response, and then she immediately proceeds to accuse the poison Skittle.
Yep.
So it's a displacement of the real.
I mean, she's trying to do the impossible. She's trying to engage in critical thinking during a fight or flight response. It's not possible. You shouldn't try it. You can't do it. And I am getting jumpy right now because I'm getting the wrap. So we have to call it for this episode. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast on the FU Network, reminding you, thinking is good for you, even when it hurts sometimes. Mouse, you have the last word.
Read Terry Pratchett.
This is fun. The FU Network.